Hello and welcome back to the Extra Movie Butter Podcast. Gentlemen, we are back. I'm here as always with my two amazing co-hosts, the one and only JTE and the illustrious Benny Hamlin. Gentlemen, Ghostbusters came out this weekend. I know you guys both loved it. I can't wait for our review.
The only ghost I want to talk about is Dale. They like, come on, we want to go home. Can't wait to talk about that teaser from Beetlejuice.
We definitely will get to the Beetlejuice trailer, because come on, how great was that? And of course, our third segment's the Ghostbuster Frozen Empire review. We are joined by a real-life Ghostbuster, the co-host of the Ford Fiesta podcast, the one and only Paul Preston. We're very excited. The dude owns a real-life Ecto-1. Yeah, we'll dig into that later with him. But
that's true. First time I went to his house, he's like, hey, I got to show you something. Went to his garage, and I was like, oh, my God. Yeah.
I love it. Well, we are going to kick off with what we normally do with movie reviews, talk a little bit of box office news, talk a little bit of movie talk. So here's a breakdown for you guys. Here's the tale of the numbers, and then we're going to see what it tells you guys. Coming in at number one over the weekend was Ghostbusters Frozen Empire with a solid $45 million debut. Number two, Dune Part Two, $17.6 million. 4 weeks in, this movie has made $233 million domestically. Doing pretty good for itself. I heard the overall haul domestically is projected to be closer to about $900 million for Dune 2. So you got to figure that that's a nice win for Warner Brothers. Coming in at number three, Kung Fu Panda 4 with $16.8 million. 3 weeks in, it's at $133 million. Sure, we'll get a Kung Fu Panda 5 hearing those kind of numbers. Number four in its first week, Immaculate with $5.3 million. Arthur the King, the Mark Wahlberg dog extreme sports movie, coming in at number five with $4.3 million. Number six, Late Night with the Devil, coming in with $2.8 million in its first week. Imaginary from Lionsgate coming in with $2.8 million in its third week. Love Lies Bleeding, A24's Kristen Stewart-led movie with $1.5 million. PLD just loves that movie because of Ed Harris, of course. Coming in at number nine is Cabarini with $1.4 million. And rounding out our top 10 is Bob Marley, One Love, still going strong with $1.1 million. Lots of numbers, lots of movies. JT, I've told you the numbers. What does it tell you, buddy?
Yeah, pretty decent opening for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. But my prediction is we will see a pretty steep fall off come week two. Now, if you look at the Rotten Tomatoes score, the audience is actually favoring this a lot more than the critics. I believe the critics are around 46% and the audience is around 85%. I think a lot of that are the big Ghostbusters fans. The movie definitely doesn't have universal praise. You know, you'll find from our review, not all of us liked it. Some of us did. So I think it had a decent opening, but I do think it's going to drop off, especially with Kong X Godzilla literally coming out this weekend, which is going to fill that big kind of summer blockbuster hole that I think, you know, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is filling for this 1 week. So I'm expecting a big drop off for that. I saw three movies this weekend. I saw Roadhouse at home on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. I saw Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. And I saw Immaculate with Sydney Sweeney actually introduced the movie for us at AMC Burbank. So she came in, kind of gave us a little intro. And I had a lot of fun. Out of those three movies, that might have been my favorite movie-going experience this past weekend. I thought it was a really tight, solid horror film that goes kind of, you know, doesn't play it safe. It definitely is a little bit of an exploitation nun movie. I don't want to give too many more details because I think a lot of the fun of the movie is kind of discovering it as you go. But Sydney Sweeney, you know, listen, her last movie made a lot of money, a romantic comedy, Anyone But You. Now she produced a small little horror film, and I think it made around $4 million, you said, which I think for Neon is pretty damn good. So this is a movie I think will definitely maybe have a cult following as time goes on. Kung Fu Panda, I still need to see. So it's the one I've seen all the Kung Fu Panda movies. I hear this one is a little bit of diminishing returns. I hear it's still solid, but not as good as the original trilogy. But I still want to check it out because I love Jack Black and I just love martial art films. So it's kind of playing to my demographic. So yeah, that's my thoughts on those. Nothing else really stuck out to me except for those three.
Benny, what does the tale of the numbers tell you, buddy?
It tells me that people really liked Ghostbusters Afterlife, and Ghostbusters Afterlife is a great movie. And I think that's why it made $45 million. I'm with JTE. I don't think it's going to hold very well, especially because Godzilla versus Kong kind of goes after the exact same demographic. And I think Dune 2 is getting a lot of like repeat business from the hardcore sci-fi people. So I think it's going to be a real rough week two for it. And like, on a side note, like Bob Marley, One Love, still pulling in $1 million. Like, it's out like for, on home video now. Like, you can just watch it at home. And I was just completely caught off guard by how well that movie did. Like, I thought the trailers for it was awful. You know, like I said, I come from an area of the country where there's no real love for Bob Marley. Like, you know, you don't ever just run into people listening to Bob Marley where I live. So, like, it caught me completely off guard how well that movie is held, how well it's done. And it's a pleasant surprise. You know, it's always cool when movies make money. And so those are the two main takeaways for me. And the other one is just that horror is the most consistent genre in film right now. There are a couple of horror movies in the top 10. They all are done with really low budgets. So even the bad ones can make a little money, you know, going forward. Like in the 80s, you got a lot of really shitty comedies and really shitty action movies made on small budgets that went into theaters. And now that's what they're doing with horror movies. And I hope someday it sparks the soul of some greedy corporate type. Maybe we should do this with comedies and action movies too. We can get those pumped back into theaters on a weekly basis. So that's my takeaway from the box office, and that's my dream for this box office.
Can I just add, I love the point of like horror movies, you know, they don't cost a lot, because to me, the best horror movies are the ones that kind of leaves a portion of the horror to your imagination. Like, if you just point a camera at a door with the right lighting and right sound and music, it could be scary. Action movies, you have to blow up like a whole house, like Invasion USA, you have to blow up a whole mall. So it's harder to make those low budget action movies. But I would love a Blumhouse action movie kind of, you know, branch where they just made low budget action films. But it's harder to make those movies low budget because they actually have to, you know, blow up the boat or, you know, jump off the building. Whereas horror is just, it's made for this budget filmmakers, I feel like.
But as far as comedies go, like, a lot of the best comedies are just like three or four cats sitting around in the house talking shit. You that's don't true. Need any money to make a comedy.
Yeah, Office Space didn't cost a lot of money to make, and that's the cost.
Well, folks, if you do love horror, go back an episode, because we had our horror Oscars last week. Tune into that. That was a great time. We had our buddies Melissa Woody and Andy Merriweather on the show. We had a great time. Exorcist. Still deemed the best horror movie of all time. My takeaway, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire came in $1 million more than Ghostbusters Afterlife. I am leaning towards agreeing with you guys that I don't know if the following weeks coming up are going to be kind to Ghostbusters. But following Kong, there's not too many more big releases until we get to May, and then we're obviously going to be slammed with big releases. So Ghostbusters might Frozen Empire might have some pretty decent legs. It's got $100 million budget, so $45 million for your opening weekends, pretty good start. I do think that this movie will end up making money. I do think it'll have some legs in the box office, but yeah, a lot of people are going back to Dune. You look at that $233 million over 4 weeks, like, that movie is kicking ass. That's kind of, and because of the runtime, you look at that as like an Oppenheimer. People went back in droves over and over and over last year to see Oppenheimer, 3-hour movie. So I do think that Dune will continue to chew up big chunks of the box office. I, like you guys, have not seen Kung Fu Panda 4 yet. Not because I don't want to, but it's because if I have time for one movie, I usually am going to go see the brand new movie that's coming out. So I am looking forward to seeing that. I agree with Benny. Bob Marley, One Love appeared a couple of days ago on my streaming channel, and it's still making money in theaters. So I'm also celebrating that movie and saying $95 million for that movie that cost $30 million to make. That's pretty freaking good return. So good for you. I think that's Paramount Pictures that released that one. And that's a cool story, hearing that Sydney Sweeney came out and introduced Immaculate. That's awesome, man. So really, I mean, the box office kind of went the way that I thought it was going to go this weekend. No real surprises, no real upsets. Ghostbusters was the big release. It made the money. Okay, that's usually how it should work in the box office. We are going to jump into some movie news, and I picked a couple of stories. And we'll start with what JT hearkened to earlier. Let's talk about some new trailers that came out, gentlemen. Obviously, the big one is Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, the sequel to Tim Burton's 80s Beetlejuice movie, bringing back Michael Keaton, bringing back Catherine O'Hara, bringing back Winona Ryder, introducing Jenna Ortega. You guys saw it. It had the Day-O, but it was a very sad and somber version of the Day-O, a little more spookier. And then at the end, we just get the iconic shot of Keaton standing there, and he's like, the juice is loose. I'm going to kick it off. I'm stoked for this movie. Beetlejuice has quietly been like one of my favorite, like weird, dark horror comedies. Like my entire life, I've loved this movie. And you have to praise Michael Keaton. He's in the movie for like 7 minutes total. And to just, one, be in a movie for 7 minutes, playing the title character that people just can't get enough of. Keaton still got the spark. He still got the charm. He still got the charisma. The dude's like 71 years old, and we saw him at the Oscars. That was our favorite moment of the Oscars, and I immediately saw this. And as soon as I saw him in full Beetlejuice makeup, I was like, I'm in. Take my money now. I'm in. I think this movie's going to be great. I watched an interview with him on Jimmy Kimmel where he was promoting his movie that he directed, but then he turned to Jimmy Kimmel when Jimmy brought up Beetlejuice, and he was like, this movie's going to be really, really good. So, listen, I understand he's got to play it up for the cameras, but I think that this movie is going to be really, really good. Burton, I really liked the Wednesday series that Tim Burton put out. That's just weird enough to be right in his, like, sweet spot. And I think Beetlejuice is right in Tim Burton's sweet spot, too. Like, he really, like, if you go back over the last, like, decade, he's had a lot of misses on his resume. Coming back to a character like Beetlejuice, this is perfect for him. So I'm very excited for this movie. How about you guys? What'd you think of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice trailer?
Yeah, I texted this trailer to both of you the second it dropped.
Yes.
Because I watched it and I was like, yes. Great teaser. Does exactly what you want. Sets up, you know, nostalgia. But also what I liked was when the trailer shows in the diagrams breaking up of the town, it looks all practical. And a lot of things I've read is that they went practical for this for the most part. Beetlejuice, honestly, is probably my favorite just straight-up Tim Burton movie. I mean, yes, I love Batman 1989. That's Batman. Beetlejuice is something that completely came from the mind of Tim Burton. And I have this weird theory where I feel like directors, a lot of times, their earlier work are some of their best works. It's just like, because you're getting pure, unfiltered. That director's been waiting to make a movie for so long, and they're just, you can feel the crazy energy flowing out of them. And yes, you know, Pee-wee was something that was already established. Big, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure is a great Tim Burton movie with a great marriage of a character created by Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens. But Beetlejuice was the first time I felt like he was able to just be like, let me show you how weird and funny I could be and how creative I could be. I love Beetlejuice. It's, like I said, it's probably my favorite Tim Burton movie. So I was pumped for this trailer. It gave me everything I wanted, nostalgia. I love that Day-O by the Kids Choir. It was just fantastic. So I'm all on board for this movie. And I also heard, I saw the same interview where he said, like, this is going to be a really good movie. And I'm really excited to hear that. I hear William Dafoe is amazing in it. Like, he plays a ex-stuntman who died, like, while making a movie and is now, like, a detective. That's and I think that's just a great concept. And how has William Dafoe never done a Tim Burton movie before? That feels a marriage made in heaven. So listen, sometimes these legacy sequels don't always turn out to be very good. We'll talk about that later. But I'm hoping I'm hoping Beetlejuice will be more of a Creed and less of a Certain Empire.
So I think of Tim Burton and Wes Anderson a lot in the same group. As they're guys that can only make their one kind of movie. And generally speaking, I'm not a huge Tim Burton fan. There are a couple times where his like style just really hit the property. Like Batman 89 really hit the property. But JTE is right, where I like Batman 89 better overall. But the most Tim Burton of Tim Burton is where it fit the best was in Beetlejuice. And him going back to that, you know, that's where he belongs. And that movie perfectly fit like 80s Winona Ryder, sort of that gothy teen. And Jenna Ortega is sort of the modern Winona Ryder. So her playing her daughter, it's all like perfect fits. And like, it's coming right, you know, Michael Keaton's comeback, he's back, he's established. All of this lines up perfectly. So even though I'm not like the biggest Tim Burton fan, I do really like Beetlejuice, but this is all the pieces looking like they're going to come together at the right time. So I'm very excited to see it.
Next trailer, we got our first look at Alien Romulus. Out of the hands of Ridley Scott into Fede Alvarez directing Alien Romulus. It seems like a match made in heaven, right? For this franchise, for this director. Benny, what did you think of Alien Romulus?
Is Fede Alvarez, did he do the most recent Evil Dead movie?
No, he did the remake.
The 2013. He did Don't Breathe, The Girl in the Spider's Web.
Yeah, and then the Evil Dead remake, which the last Evil Dead movie was a sequel, I think, kind of to that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, aside from the point, had he done the most recent Evil Dead, which I thought was okay, I'd have been more excited hearing that he was the one that did the remake. You know, my excitement is a little lessened, but I hated the trailer, by the way. I don't like the over-the-shot video game, like, top cutaway view. I don't like that in movies. I don't like that in trailers. I think it makes the movies look cheap, and I think it makes them look gimmicky. I know that it worked in John Wick that one time, but that's the one time it's worked. To me, that always makes it look cheap and like you weren't confident enough in what you were making just to show what you were making. So in the end, like, I always will go to see Alien movies. Like, I even like the bad ones. Like, I love Alien versus Predator. So I will be there to watch it because I like the franchise, but I hated the trailer.
Mm. Wow, JT, what did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was a good trailer. Like, I tweeted this out when I saw it, and it's kind of how I feel to this day. I said, yep, looks like an Alien movie. It doesn't seem to bring, doesn't, for that trailer, it almost feels like a remake of the original Alien. He's definitely going for that vibe, more horror, more, you know, they're stuck on a ship. So I am hoping, because this is just a teaser, I'm hoping the next trailer shows us, like, what's he bringing new to the franchise? Because we are at like number 5 or 6 or 7. I don't know what number Alien movie we're into, but there's been a lot. And if you're just kind of trying to recapture the glory of the first Alien, that's cool. I like that you're going with that kind of tone. But I'm also curious to see what you're bringing new to the table. And at times, like I said, if you said this was a remake trailer, I would have believed you. I was like, oh, there's a girl with a gun at the end. There's the ship. There's the pods. Oh, this is like a new Alien remake. But this is not a remake. It is a sequel. So that, I think this one takes place closer to the timeline of the first Alien film. I don't know, again, I don't know what the story is or the plot-wise, but I am curious to see what he brings new to the table, because if you're going to make a new Alien film, you got to bring something new.
I think Fede Alvarez, this is right, and Fede Alvarez is like wheelhouse. Like, if you look at some of the movies he's done, like Evil Dead, it all takes place in a cabin. Don't Breathe, all takes place in that one guy's house. Like, he's good at these, like, close-quarter atmospheric horror movies, and this is, come on, it's perfect. Like, if he's doing a sequel to the original Alien, right, and it's taking place around that time and other, you know, colonial marines or other, like, space explorers are experiencing the xenomorphs, like, it makes sense. I think we're going to get exactly what we should anticipate from this movie. It's an alien loose on the ship. Only a couple people are going to survive. It's going to be crazy. But the one thing Fede Alvarez does do really well, and I have seen both of his horror movies, is he does do like fantastical kills. So I think we can expect some crazy alien murdering to be happening in this movie. But yeah, I'm with you guys. It's not like this trailer blew me away. I looked at it and was like, this all makes perfect sense to me. We're going to get another Alien movie. Makes sense. And of course, I'm assuming the ship is going to be Romulus. That's, the aliens are always naming their the movies after the ship. So yeah, makes sense to me. I'm in. Sounds good. He's the right director for the right movie.
I'm curious, what were your guys' thoughts on Ridley's last two Alien films with Prometheus and Alien Covenant? Were you fans, or was it just too off the path for you?
I enjoy both of them, but like I said, I generally like the franchise, even the bad entries. I personally do not like the aliens being like bioengineered, like that personally I didn't care for, but I found the movies generally entertaining. And I really liked Prometheus up to a point. I think both of them kind of lose it at the end, but the first parts of both movies I thought were really good.
I think Prometheus is like beautifully made. Like as far as like a movie making spectacle, like it's up there as one of like the like best made. But I like Benny, like I like large portions of these movies, and then it gets to the point where it just falls apart. Covenant, like I knew the reveals, like I could see them coming kind of a mile away with some of the like shock factors. I like Prometheus, I think, a little bit better than I do Covenant. But I agree with Benny 100%. I think the last probably like 30% of those movies lose the movie entirely. Well, we're going to skip past trailers because I got a couple more stories that I really want to get your guys' opinion on. And one of them is once again about the new Jurassic Park movie, Jurassic World, in that franchise. This movie, directed by Gareth Edwards, as we know now, is in talks and negotiating with one two-time Oscar-nominated actress Scarlett Johansson to be the star of the upcoming Jurassic World movie. For me, this movie's starting to take shape. It's starting to go from something that we all went like, let it die, to now I'm going, okay, wait a minute, you might have something here. And so now I'm super intrigued. If they land Scarlett Johansson, listen, she is still a draw. Like, This is an actress who got two nominations, a Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress in 1 year. Like, she is capable. We've all seen her do action movies. We've seen her do drama. Like, this is a perfect movie for her, especially directed by Gareth Edwards. Like, the guy knows how to be able to draw out, like, good performances in his movies, especially strong female performances in his movies. So I'm all for this. Man, if she lands this movie... this movie just all of a sudden went to one of my most anticipated movies of next year. This movie went from literally me rolling my eyes going like, I mean, I love dinosaurs, but let them go extinct. To now I'm like, no, keep cloning them. Let's go. I don't know. How do you boys feel about it?
It's an interesting point because to me, like as far as who's acting in it, until I know the plot or the just a basic plot synopsis, I can't get too excited because I have no idea who Scarlett Johansson will be playing. Do I like to see her in a Jurassic Park movie? Sure. But until I know what the skeleton of this movie is, who is she playing? Is she playing ex-Special Forces? I think the rumor is she's playing a scientist of some sorts. Like, I just don't know what the movie is going to be about. We know it's going to look amazing because Gareth Edwards knows how to make a great-looking movie. David Koepp, the original writer of Jurassic Park, is returning, so I'm excited for that. I just – give me like a log line. Give me just like the – you know, the elevator pitch, so I can get an idea of what the heck we're getting into. There's only so many actors where I'm going to be like, oh my God, like if they announced Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to be the next Jurassic Park movie, you got my attention because I don't know what the hell that's going to be. I would love for him to be the new, like, oh God, what's the old guy's name?
John Hammond.
Yeah, I want Arnold to be the new John Hammond. Same Hawaiian shirt, the nice straw hat with that accent. Oh, beautiful. So, I do think having Scarlett, the fact you're going for a big actress, you know, she is a box office draw. I think that's great. But I can't really get excited until I at least know something about what the story is going to be.
Okay, we're cooking on this new movie because I just want him to be like, spad no expense. That sounds great.
To try to say the toy tops.
He's like, we have a Tyrannosaurus.
Like, I have no idea if Scarlett Johansson will fit the movie well. But if they sign her, I will be optimistic in the fact that she doesn't seem to be somebody that works for paychecks.
Yes.
Like, she generally only signs on to stuff that she thinks will be good. Now, that doesn't always mean that it is or that it always suits my taste. But she is somebody that's very in control of her own career. And she's just not signing on to, like, cheap sci-fi schlock. So if she's agreeing to lead the franchise, then they've at least made a pitch to her that sounds like, oh, this could be something really good. And the fact that it's going through an extra level of filtering, at least there's somebody that knows what it is to make very successful franchise movies, is looking at it and saying, yeah, I think this can be great. That gives me a lot more confidence than I had a month ago, just because if she's willing to sign, it means she looks at it and she thinks it's going to be good. And usually she hits with that. Like, you know, she's in Jojo Rabbit. She's in the MCU. She's not, you know, she's not signing on to do 65 or the Fast and the Furious.
See, that's a very, very good point. And that was kind of what made this exciting for me. Scarlett Johansson is that kind of established actress that doesn't have to just take any movie that comes along. She can be selective. She has made plenty of money in the MCU movies. So, yeah, that's a very, very good point, Benny. Like, she can be selective. And so something about this pitch, something about this script is obviously jumping out to her. So I'm now optimistic about this Jurassic Park movie, especially if they land her. I'm excited for it. I got two more stories. We're going to end with a sad one, but we're going to pitch this next one. Kind of an interesting story. Happy Gilmore 2, currently in the works. Adam Sandler himself is helping to write the script for a sequel to a 90s classic, Happy Gilmore. Probably one of Sandler's more notable roles, probably one of his best, aside from maybe The Waterboy. I think those two, maybe Mr. Deeds, you can probably throw in Billy Madison in those, were kind of the golden age of Adam Sandler. So I'm curious your guys' thoughts. Happy Gilmore 2, like, is it going to be titled like Shooter's Revenge or some shit like that? Like, I don't know. I don't know what to make of this story. I don't know how much of it is going to be like Netflix. And it's, we're going to get a ridiculous six version of Happy Gilmore 2. But Benny, what do you think?
Adam Sandler is a great dramatic actor that picks really shitty roles. He's not funny. He wasn't really funny in the 90s. He's not going to be funny now. And his Netflix movies are terrible. So this is going to be an Adam Sandler comedy that is a Netflix movie. There is no way that this is not an absolute train wreck. Not going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with Benny. Netflix is all you had to say. It's like, once he made that deal with Netflix, he's just made awful comedy after awful comedy. Because at least when he was making movies with the studio, he had an answer to somebody. There were producers. There were studio heads that said, hey, let's try this. This might not be a good idea. Netflix, I think, basically just gives him a blank check and left to his own devices. He's made awful comedy after awful comedy. I just have no – I mean, would I love to see Happy Gilmore 2 if it was done under a studio like Paramount and producers and Judd Apatow's producing and all this stuff? Sure. I'd have some hope. But if he's making it Netflix with his crew, I can't see how it's going to be anything but horrible.
I'm inclined to agree. I mean, look, Sandler in his prime, like, I can go back and watch Billy Madison and just – purely enjoy it and go back and watch The Waterboy, Mr. Deeds, Happy Gilmore, and just unabashedly enjoy these movies. But they were kind of a product of the time, and I feel like so was Sandler. Man, his comedic stuff lately is just bad. They're all misses, every one of them. I don't care what you say. Like Benny said, he is a great dramatic actor. Uncut Gems prove that. I want to see a little bit more. Like, I haven't yet seen The Spaceman. I've heard divisive stuff about it, but I've heard that his performance is solid. So that one's one I think I'll probably watch in the next week because I enjoy watching Sandler do dramatic roles, but I think this movie is going to be awful, awful, awful. Okay, well, we all agree on that one. That might be the only time tonight. And our last story, sadly, we do need to pay a little homage to the passing of M. Emmett Walsh. If you don't know the name, I can guarantee you, folks, you have seen him. You have seen him in 50 movies that you have seen throughout your life. He most notably was, for me, I saw him in Knives Out. You may have recognized him from movies like Help Me Out Here, Boys.
Best of Back to School, Best of Times, Blood Simple, Ordinary People, Slapshot.
A Time to Kill, Free Willy, Camp Nowhere, The Glass Shield, Cops and Robertsons. Like, this guy has been everywhere in these movies. And you would recognize him absolutely from his distinct voice. It is always sad when we lose talent, especially character actors that we have seen for generations. This guy has been acting since the 60s. Excuse me. I had to look it up. He's been acting since the 60s. 88 years old. M. Emmett Walsh, I don't think anybody will do it quite as well as you. You portrayed, as always, the character actor. We will miss you, sir.
Yeah, it's funny. When you mentioned him, like, I saw the news earlier today, and it's one of those persons, I didn't know his name, but the second I saw his face, I was like, oh, yeah, I've seen this guy in movies. I might not remember them all, but Blood Simple is the one that obviously comes to mind, one of the early Coen Brother films. He's like one of the leads in that film. He's the villain in a lot of ways. So he's somebody, when I see him and we were talking off camera, I'm like, what else has he been in? And then he mentioned all his movies. I'm like, oh my God. Yes. I remember him from this. I remember him from that. So he's one of those great character actors who, again, you might not remember his name, but you'll see his face. You'll remember him immediately.
Yeah. This is one of the ones that hurts, man. Cause he's just like somebody to me. It's like, always in the background of everything that I love, like Best of Times, one of my favorite movies of all time, Slapshot, one of my favorite movies of all time. You know, he's in Fletch, he's in Blade Runner. It's like, if there's a great movie, like between like 1975 and 2010, there's like a 25% chance Emmett Walsh was in that thing, man. And so, I mean, he was 88. That's a great run for any human being, you know? And
yeah.
You know, hope his family is, you know, at peace, and, you know, our thoughts are with him. But that is a career, man. Like, if you look back at everything he did, like, any actor on earth would have been lucky to be in all that stuff. And, you know, I thank him because he contributed a lot. Like, most of my childhood was spent watching VHSs that I got for a dollar from Enon Video, man. And he was in half of those bad boys. So thank you, Mr. Walsh, and good luck in your future endeavors, man.
We are going to take a break. Up next, we are going to give our review. That's right, folks. We're doing two reviews tonight. We're going to review Roadhouse. Stick around. I'm going to rip out your jugular.
How's a guy like you end up a boss?
Just lucky, I guess.
Dalton's an unusual guy, and he's got an unusual job. His reputation is impressive.
I run the show completely.
And his demands are simple.
Be nice until it's time to not be nice.
Patrick Swayze.
Do you always carry your medical records around with you?
Saves time.
Roadhouse, rated R. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
From the director of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. When two ghosts can't talk the living into leaving their house.
What's the good of being a ghost if you can't frighten people away?
They call the ghost
Beetlejuice
with the most.
Yeah. Can you be scary?
What do you think of this?
This is amazing.
Michael Keaton is a ghost called Beetlejuice.
I'm the ghost with the most, babe.
Rated PG. Sneak preview Saturday, March 26th.
You know what I feel like we're missing in life? People ripping out each other's throats. That's my clever segue into our next topic, which is going to be the Roadhouse remake review. Now, stay tuned. After this, we're going to have the amazing Paul Preston on for our review of Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire. But now we're going to talk about Jake Gyllenhaal, Doug Liman, Conor McGregor, in the Florida Keys, and some fighting. As always, we're going to do non-spoiler. Benny, kick us off. What did you think of the Roadhouse remake with Jake Gyllenhaal?
It reminded me a lot when they started making the sequels to the Kickboxer movie with the guy from Step by Step.
It felt
a lot like that. And that's pretty much my thoughts on it. Like, the most entertaining thing about this movie was the shit talk between Doug Liman and the studio and the trades, man. Like, the movie is a streaming movie, and it is what it is. But that's really all my thoughts. It's a below average streaming action movie treading on some great IP name that has nothing to do with the IP. That's what it is.
JT?
Yeah, first of all, Roadhouse is one of my favorite 80s action movies ever. I love the movie growing up. I named my English bulldog Dalton after Patrick Swayze because I just always want an English bulldog. And I love Roadhouse growing up. I love the Swayze. I was like, oh, Dalton's a great name. I love the movie where he comes in, like, his name is Dalton. it's a great name. I never met anybody named Dalton before. Maybe you guys have. But the only Dalton I had in my universe was Patrick Swayze. And then Leo came and did Rick Dalton from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and the name got a whole new lease on life. So I was, you know, when I heard they were remaking this movie, immediately I'm like, why? The movie is such a product of its time. It is a movie produced by Joel Silver in the height of the cocaine 80s, where everything was done not tongue-in-cheek, but sincere. And they thought, you watch Roadhouse, it has the same cinematographer, I believe, who shot Jurassic Park. Like, they actually had top tier talent working on his B movie that got an A budget. So it is just a relic of its time. It's amazing. Patrick Swayze is amazing. Sam Elliott, great young Sam Elliott in the original Roadhouse. I would love just to review Roadhouse sometime. I could talk about that movie for an hour. Now, the two things that this movie did have going for me was Doug Liman, who I think is, for the most part, a good director. I love Edge of Tomorrow. I like The Bourne Identity. I even like Jumper that he did with Hayden Christensen. I think that's a pretty decent little sci-fi action movie. Doug Liman also made one of my favorite comedies of the 90s with Swingers. I also like this follow-up Go. So Doug Liman, for the most part, I think he's a really good, solid filmmaker. And I think Jake Gyllenhaal, given the right material, can play to that material. I will once again use this as an excuse to talk about his masterclass performance in Ambulance, the Michael Bay film. That is an actor who completely tunes into the type of movie that he's making and is going over the top because he's working with an over-the-top filmmaker. Ambulance, I think, will be a modern-day B-movie action masterpiece. About 20 years from now, people will go back and be like, Ambulance, man. Hell yeah. This movie is not that. I think, I'll be honest, the first 20 to 30 minutes, I had some hope because I kind of liked the thing Gyllenhaal's going for here. He's like this guy who's just shrugs his shoulders at every little thing and doesn't get intimidated or scared at anything. And I thought the introduction to his character was really interesting and kind of fun. But the movie just, it's 2 hours, which is way too long. And once McGregor shows up, it's like he thinks he's in a Muppet movie. He's just overacting to a point that is unbelievable and to the point where it's distracting and pulls you out of the actual movie. I think he could have been good in this movie, but he needed to scale it back about 110% and just let his physique be his intimidation. Instead, he is talking like a madman on speed, and everything he says sounds so forced and over the top that it took me out of the movie. Some of the fight scenes are good, but also at times Doug Liman feels like he's using some sort of like CGI trickery. That is not what I want in my Roadhouse movie. I just want two guys fighting with their shirts off, oiled in baby oil, and sweating and doing Tai Chi in front of the lake and ripping throats out. And I want no CGI. I want good choreography. Let the camera sit back. So to me, this movie overall, it's more of a decent curiosity than it is a good movie at all, honestly. It's something I think if you are absolutely bored and have nothing else to watch, throw it on. And you might have some fun with it, but it by no means will it come close to the original Roadhouse, which is a classic of the 80s.
So old Conor McGregor owns a whiskey brand, Irish whiskey. It's called Proper 12. It's okay. It basically tastes like Jameson with Splenda in it. If you had me sit down and drink an entire bottle of Proper 12, and then force me to watch this movie, I might bite my own tongue to attempt to commit suicide. This movie's awful. I like Doug Liman. And I like some of the stuff that he's put out. I love Edge of Tomorrow. It's one of my favorite sci-fi movies. I like Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I like The Bourne Identity. Like, I agree. Like, I like Swingers. I like a lot of what he puts out. I don't understand this movie. So I live in San Dimas, California, right? And 11, 12 years ago, before I was in a relationship, before I was married, there was one place to go in San Dimas. And this was probably 13 to 14 years ago. The only bar in town was a country bar named Montana's. And the bouncer at the door, the like claim to fame with this bar was the bouncer at the door was actually in the movie Roadhouse. That's about the only nice thing I have to say. And that's not even really a compliment as much as it is a story. I very much dislike this movie. I can see Gyllenhaal. Listen, they buffed him up. I can absolutely see Gyllenhaal being in action, like taking kind of a turn in his career to do a little more action movies. He's good in like in the physicality of the role, but the dialogue in this movie is atrocious. And I'm sorry, but Conor McGregor, every single time I see Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor on screen, they have this stupid shit-eating smile the entire time. Both of them, always. It doesn't matter the stakes of the fight. It doesn't matter what's happening. They have the shit-eating grin on their face. It's so distracting. This movie makes no sense to me. I did not like it at all. I like you, JT. Within like the first 25 minutes, I'm like, there might be something here. When he first goes to the bar, like we'll go into spoilers. When he first shows up to the bar and he has the fight and he kind of beats up those guys. It's kind of like he doesn't want to do this. And he drives him to the hospital. I'm like, okay, I see where this movie is going. This could be fun. And then it just takes a left turn and goes down who knows what alley and becomes this crazy mess of a movie.
You are exactly like up until that point. It is a Roadhouse movie. It's just this guy, he's going down there to be a bouncer. He's going to kick the shit out of a bunch of rednecks. That's the pocket of a Roadhouse movie. And then I don't know why, man, this movie takes a hard left turn. Conor McGregor's performance is the worst performance in a major motion picture in years. I don't even recall a performance like in a real major big time movie this bad. I mean, it is uniquely terrible. And then it, for some reason, like Jake Gyllenhaal's character, like after that first 20 minutes where it's in the pocket, he goes from being UFC fighter and bouncer to I'm an assassin and I have no problems killing a bunch of people. Most UFC fighters don't go around knifing people and be like, I'm cool with that, buddy. And then like the third act of this movie is stupid as fuck. I'm sorry for the profanity, America. There's no other way to describe it. It's like the last 20 minutes of this movie is like deleted scenes from Fast X. It's just so fucking bad.
Yeah, I agree. The movie just kind of goes off the rails. The first 20 minutes, it felt like, you know, we've got a little bit of a Roadhouse movie happening here. And I don't understand the UFC background, the whole thing of him like accidentally killing a guy in the ring. Like on paper, I could see that being like an interesting take, but Jake Gyllenhaal's character is just kind of like this. Patrick Swayze's character was like smart. He practiced Tai Chi. He knew philosophy. He actually had like an emotional reaction to things that were happening to him. Like he felt like an actual human being. Gyllenhaal feels almost like a video game avatar who could just pretty much do whatever he needs to do to get the job done. He doesn't have any compassion. He seems just annoyed by everything. I mean, they tried to play the relationship with him and the kid at the bookstore, but that didn't really work for me. What makes Original Roadhouse so good is it's like a Western. It's a guy who comes into a town and the evil owner of the properties starts, you know, terrorizing the whole town. And it really is just a Western updated into a modern setting. At least the year it came out in the 80s was a modern setting. Whereas this just because you can't do that now. It doesn't work unless putting him in the Florida Keys, having this rich, like, I'm not even sure what kind of criminal he was. Like, what? I didn't know he wants a property. Like, what does this guy do? His henchmen are jokes. And Conor McGregor, if you would have just had him not talk, it would have been 100 times more effective. But he talks, and they even talk to each other while they're fighting. And it undercuts all of the fun I was having. Roadhouse, what makes it great is because it plays it straight. It doesn't wink at the camera. It's just doing what it's supposed to do to tell the story. This movie is trying to have its cake and eat it too, and it's trying to wink at the camera and have McGregor and him having like this piano's out of tune as he's like hitting with the piano. Like, what am I watching here? Is this Looney Tunes?
Yeah. Also, being a UFC fighter qualifies you to be an expert in all things like. He looks at a guy and he goes, that guy has a knife under his shirt. Oh, you got that from sparring in the octagon. You're able to just detect that. Like, there were so many like seeds that, like, as my wife and I were watching, I like turned and I was like, okay, now he's an expert on boat repair. Like, the UFC taught him that. That was like the ongoing joke that like the two of us had as like things were occurring. It was like, oh, he learned that training in the UFC.
Yeah. And then there's easy. He's a cooler. He works at all these things.
Yes. And then there was the other part that, like, every time something would happen in the bar, Gyllenhaal didn't do anything. He would grab the other kid, the other bartender, and he would be like, hey, that guy has a knife. And he'd sit back and he would sip his coffee. Like, there was so much of the movie where he, like, was not doing anything. He was just giving commands to other people at the bar. Where this movie completely shit the bed for me was there is a moment where it's like the food fight scene from Animal House. Like, Dalton and I think it's McGregor, the first time they're squaring off in the bar together, they start fighting, and then one guy knocks into another guy and he spills his drink, and they start fighting, and then one guy randomly stands up and yells, bar fight! And everyone in the bar starts fighting each other for no reason other than somebody stood up and yelled bar fight. It was a total like booger moment from Animal House when, or not booger, I'm sorry. What's his character's name? Bluto from Animal House. When he stands up and he yells food fight and everybody gets involved. I was like, what the fuck is happening? Again, excuse my language, but I have to say it, like, this movie is so bad. There's so many of these moments where I'm just like, oh, like, I just like kept like, oh, come on. Oh, come on. And then randomly at the end, there's like a speedboat chase and they're fighting underwater. And yeah, this movie is a hot garbe mess.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you got to compare this to the original because it's called fucking Roadhouse.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, the fact that you say that Gyllenhaal seems bored and like he's not interested in doing anything, because the difference here is he's just a guy who takes a job because he needs the money. He doesn't actually want to go there and fix this bar. He's just going there because he has sleeping in his car and he needs some money. Dalton's character in Roadhouse is like a legend. Like, he is known only as Dalton. He is known for being the best of the best. When he goes into that bar and he gives that speech, he fires the bartender, he fires one of the bouncers, and he's like, be nice until not be nice. Like, he takes command of these guys. He brings them under his wing, and he teaches them how to be good bouncers. This movie, Gyllenhaal's character is just the opposite. He's there, he's opportunity, and he grows to care eventually because he's there. So to me, just the dynamic is just all the way off from the get-go. Also, I love the original. You hear him talk to Sam Elliott, Patrick Swayze. They never show you like what he did to the guy who tried to kill him. They never show you the throat rip. You only talk about it. You only hear about it. So you're left to your imagination what could have happened. And then when it finally happens on the beach, he rips that guy's throat out. It's horrific. The girl, Jennifer Lynch, is like crying. He's like emotional. This guy's throat is on the ground. This movie at no time is playing it any way like that. It is really kind of a parody of the Roadhouse movie in a lot of ways.
And we didn't get a throat rip in this one.
I know. What the
not
hell?
One throat was ripped.
Instead, he went like, you know, Van Helsing and just stabbed him with a freaking piece of wood 10 times.
Yeah. You know, I think the most damning thing you can say about this movie is that the best performance in it is by Post Malone.
Yeah. That's true.
I don't think Gyllenhaal was bad in this. I don't think his character wasn't as well written as Swayze's, obviously. I think Gyllenhaal, for what he's asked to do, does it fairly well. So I can't really blame all on Gyllenhaal. I think he gives, unfortunately, this is the performance he was given and asked, and I think he did the best he could with what he had.
I think he does the physical stuff fine. Like, that's where, like, he actually shines in this movie is the physicality of it. I mean, the dude
looks
jacked in this movie. Ripped. But, like, as far as any acting that goes into it, it's terrible. Like, he's not acting. He's doing much better just doing the fighting choreography than anything else in this movie.
Well, he just seems annoyed that he has to do anything. And he does come off as annoyed that he has to fight these people. And I like the fact that he played, like, indifferent. He's just like, God, I'm going to break your arm. I'm going to bring you to the hospital. He's like, dude, you know, I thought it was a kind of interesting take on Dalton compared to the Swayze. At least it was different because at the end of the day, it is a remake, but I don't want a carbon copy of the original. So, like I said, I was with this movie for the first 20 minutes or so, maybe the first half hour, and then it kind of lost me as it got more and more ridiculous. And when McGregor showed up, I was like, what the hell is going on? So I don't think it was as bad as maybe you're saying. For me personally, it's started off okay, started off decently, and then at the end it was kind of like, yeah, this isn't very good. But I didn't hate my time with it. I can say that. I just thought it was, but I'm trying to divorce myself from the original, even though I have to compare it, because I don't want just a remake of the original. I want to at least take the name, do something different with it. They did some different stuff, but unfortunately, 80% of it was not successful.
You know it's going to be a bad movie when your two biggest villains are A, Conor McGregor, and then the other guy was Billy Magnussen, who I just can't not see in Game Night. That's all I see him, like, I can't see him in any other role. Like, he was in the last Daniel Craig Bond movie as a bad guy, and I'm like,
yeah, he was good in that.
I was like, no. Like, I can't see him in anything other than a comedic role.
And I did like his death scene. I like that McGregor just snapped his neck, and I like the fact he flew off the boat like a freaking ragdoll.
There was definitely some bonkers shit that happened in this movie, that is for sure. Well, I think we can probably wrap this up. I mean, look, I was obviously way over exaggerating the drinking the proper 12 and killing myself before watching this movie. We were joking around earlier that the best way to be able to watch this movie is to turn it on and then do housework. Like, it's fine. It feels, if you're into, like, turn your brain off and watch action movies, you really got to turn your brain off. That's where the proper 12 will help. And you'll find some, lower your expectations, shut off your brain, and you'll find some enjoyment in this movie. The fight scenes are worth it. I will say that. The fight scenes are very well choreographed.
Also, when I watch a streaming movie like this, I have to compare it to, like, other streaming movies. Like, Red Notice is horrible. The one with...
Oh, yeah.
What was the one with Gal Gadot? I don't know. What was that one freaking called? I can't even remember. I'll just call it Red Notice 2.
Yeah, like
those movies are unwatchable to me. This movie is at least watchable, even though it's not very good. It's, if you're not paying anything, you're not going out of your way to watch this in the theater, watch this over most of the Netflix action movies.
Heart of Stone. That was
bad.
Was the Gal Gadot movie.
So bad. Red Notice was horrible too. Gray Man was actually okay. I'll give Ryan Gosling some credit for that one. And Chris Evans. But as far as streaming action movies, you could do a lot worse than Roadhouse. That'll be my final word.
Go watch Land of Bad instead. It's also streaming as much. Oof.
Land of Bad is good. Yeah, I'm with Banana. And go watch Ambulance. It's underappreciated.
Ambulance is good. I agree with you.
Ambulance is fine. Gyllenhaal's a little manic for me in that one.
It's a Michael Bay movie. You've got to be manic.
Yeah.
If you're not at 11, you're in the wrong movie.
I really like that Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
Like, yeah, he's great.
He was good in that one. I'll have to rewatch that one. I remember watching that one when it first came out and was like, yeah, okay, yeah, it was a fun action movie. And I haven't revisited since. I'm going to revisit it this week for you.
I'll do the same.
Well, folks, we are going to take a break, of course, but tune in because up next we have our Ghostbusters Frozen Empire with the real living Ghostbuster himself. The man owns an Ecto-1, Paul Preston. Stay tuned.
Ghosts, they're real. They're here. And someone's got to stop them. It's a job for professionals. It's a job for the Ghostbusters.
Hey, anybody see a ghost?
They're the best.
Oh.
the brave, the only Ghostbusters, coming to save the world this summer.
We're ready to believe you.
Who you gonna call?
Rated PG.
We're the best. We're the beautiful. We're the only Ghostbusters.
The wait is over.
Happy New Year.
And the fun's about to begin.
Are we all going mad?
Yeah!
The Ghostbusters are back.
It's slime time.
Two in the box.
Ready to go.
We be faster.
They be slow.
Ghostbusters 2.
We're back!
An Ivan Reitman film rated PG.
Ghostbusters!
Opens Friday at theaters everywhere.
Welcome back, folks, and we are joined by a real-life Ghostbuster to review Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, the co-host of the Ford Fiesta podcast, one half of the movie guys, the one, the only, Mr. Paul Preston.
Greetings and salutations, gentlemen.
Thank you so much for being here, man.
My pleasure. You know, the gods gave me a present on my birthday of a new Ghostbusters movie. I mean, that was exactly my birthday's not the 22nd, but you know how movies open on the Thursday before? So technically, I called that a win. And yeah, so I got that for a present, new Ghostbusters movie.
If you don't mind, before we get into the review, how did you come to own an Ecto-1?
Well, Adam, the other half of the movie guys, Adam Witt, says, you know, a lot of people get Porsches for midlife crises. This is what I do, I guess. This is my midlife crisis car, an Ecto-1. So yeah, I got a 20-foot Ecto-1, and it was a guy actually selling it because he bought it around 2016. It's designed after the 2016 Ecto-1, so it's got the red back, and it's a 93 Cadillac Fleetwood hearse. But this guy had done it all up, so I didn't even have to do any work. He put the junk on the top, which means nothing but looks great, you know, and he painted it all, put the logos everywhere. And he had a 15-foot Stay Puft inflatable and a Rowan inflatable that was custom made. Your villain from the 2016 one, if you don't know, it's the ghost from the logo coming to life and destroying New York. So, and there was like a giant Slimer that was handmade out of paper mache and this big barrel of slime to stick him in. So all this stuff he would go and set up at parties, and then he'd put Ghostbusters Ghostbuster uniforms on these mannequins and stick them in and around the car, and there you had a Ghostbusters themed party. But for me, hell no, I got rid of the mannequin. I'm putting on the suit, man. So like, yeah, that was the deal when I bought it, and someone was selling it. I had some inheritance for all the worst reasons, and someone sent me a link saying this is for sale, and I went, dude, I'm gonna buy that. What are you doing? This is going to happen now. And so it has happened. And needless to say, my Halloweens have been very busy.
Nice.
Can I say this? I don't know if you guys remember, but I think it was the 90s when one of the Batman movies was coming out. Taco Bell did a promotion and you could win the Batmobile from the movie. And I remember going to Taco Bell just thinking, What would I do if I won it? Because apparently it's not very easy to drive. You couldn't really see like out the window because it was so tinted. But man, that was a dream of mine. Like the ghost, having you know the Ghostbusters car is amazing. But I just always think back to that. Who was the guy that won that Taco Bell Batmobile car? And how long did he live driving it?
Thankfully, I'm renting a house in Burbank. So I had room behind my garage, actually, because the garage is used for podcasting, much like, you know, you've seen at the movie guys. But although we stream a lot lately and I'm not out there as much, but still, that's where all that stuff lives. Built a studio in there. So sorry, car, I had to go behind the garage with a tarp over it. And it really looks like, you know, in Afterlife, when they pull the tarp off the vehicle in the garage, you know, that's me every time I get up, go off to do something weird with the car. So.
Yeah, I told them when I went to your house one time and you brought me to the garage and like kind of revealed it to me. I was like, oh, what is happening? This is amazing.
Yeah, it needs some TLC for sure, but because it's 31 years old. But I'm up for it as long as, you know, we still get out there and have fun with it as frequently as I do. And so far, so good.
Nice. I got to ask you 1,000 more questions about this car, but we do have a movie review to get to.
Yes, I don't actually bust ghosts, though. That is, you know, one thing. If you're going to ask that question, the containment unit is a – but although kids, when they take it to parties, do want to get – inside the vehicle. It's like, kid, don't be in a hurry to get in a hearse. Just, you know, slow down.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Play your role. But anyway, onward with the show.
I'm sorry. I just want to clarify something really quick. You don't actually bust ghosts.
I didn't want to break your heart on the air, but I felt it had to be done. So, you know, just
one good night, everybody. Well, let's jump into it, guys. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. We're back again, this time with the group from Ghostbusters Afterlife. And of course, our original boys and gals. This time, not directed by any Reitman. This one was directed by Gil Keenan. However, it did share a writing credit with Jason Reitman. This movie, at the end of the movie, was dedicated to Ivan Reitman, much like Ghostbusters Afterlife was dedicated to Harold Ramis. So I'm going to go around. You guys tell me your unspoiler thoughts about the movie. JT, let's kick off with you, because I don't think you'd liked this movie.
Yeah, this is tough, man, because I really liked Afterlife. I watched it the week before seeing this film because I thought that was a great sequel / reboot that had a lot of heart. It had almost like a Steven Spielberg Amblin feel to it, you know, like the magic of discovery, rediscovering your roots and discovering that you're, in fact, the relative of a Ghostbuster. And I thought bringing in these new kids, Mackenzie Grace, I thought was amazing in the Afterlife. I thought podcast was pretty good. It was a good start. I love bringing in Paul Rudd. I love bringing Carrie Coon. So I feel like they really set the table for what could be a great sequel and a continuation of the Ghostbuster franchise. And unfortunately, I just didn't feel like I got that with this movie. And it felt to me very uninspired. I feel like when Jason Reitman took over and directed Afterlife, it felt like a love letter to the franchise. He almost, and according to the behind the scenes, he worked with his father. His father was like on set almost throughout the making of the whole film. It really felt like a celebration of the franchise. This movie, I think putting it in different director's hands, just, I don't know if the script is also kind of messy. There's way too many characters. Here's the thing, man. I also think this movie is not so much for the, I don't want to say that. I watched the original first two Ghostbusters movie, and it is funny at times, like gritty, realistic. It has a little bit of edge to it, a little bit of snark. Like, it is really made for adults. I mean, Dan Aykroyd gets a blowjob in the first film from a ghost. Okay, this movie is not like pandered to kids. And while I feel like Afterlife did that a little bit because you're having a more kid cast, This sequel felt more like a kid's movie to me than like a true Ghostbusters movie. Now, maybe that's just me not wanting a kid's version of the Ghostbusters. I want the SNL actors like Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, Ernie Hudson. I want Rick Moranis showing up. I want all these great character actors to come back and bring their comedy chops and their comedy with a little bit of an edge. And I love the original concept of Ghostbusters is like, what if instead of calling a plumber, this, you know, you call a plumber, guy comes over, he's kind of a smart aleck guy who's going to go drink beers after the job. But what if you called that for Ghost? And I love that aspect of the original Ghostbuster movies. And these just don't seem like, this one specifically is not going for that vibe. And I think part of me just really misses that. I didn't laugh, I think, once throughout this movie. I maybe laughed or chuckled twice, and it was mainly Kumail Nanjiani who actually had some of the bigger laughs throughout the movie for me. The old cast in this, I feel like, is just kind of sleepwalking through. They're not really given any agency in the film. And the movie I would like to bring up is like Spider-Man No Way Home. You bring back Tobey Maguire, and you bring back Andrew Garfield, and they actually like complete their arcs and give them some agency in the film and when they're talking to, you know, the new Spider-Man. I feel like Bill Murray in this movie has no agency. He's just there to put sunglasses on at one point and to make a few jokes. But he's not the same Bakeman. I know he's older, but he's not the same Bakeman with the edge that I missed. I think Paul Rudd, you know, doesn't really have much to do in this movie. I don't think Finn Wolfhard has much to do with this movie. I thought the villain was lame. I thought the finale was really lame. John Flickinger had a great tweet where he said, the first film ends with basically a giant kaiju battle against a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man that feels epic. The second film, the Statue of Liberty is going through the streets. You feel the whole city is alive. You feel the whole city is watching this event of the Ghostbusters battling Vigo. This one takes place in the garage of the, doesn't leave the garage of the firehouse. And that's not really a spoiler because that's in the trailer. What you see in the trailer is basically what you see in the movie. They don't leave that garage. And I'll get to some more stuff in spoilers, but I want to go see Ghostbusters movies to laugh. I want to go to be thrilled and maybe a little bit scared. And I don't think I got any of those, to be honest with you. So pretty disappointing, but I know some people out there like it. Maybe I'm going with, you know, different expectations. You know what? I will say this. I do feel it's kind of like I said, and this might have been a little too harsh. It's the Crystal Skull of the Ghostbusters franchise. But listen, there's people out there that like Crystal Skull. There are people out there that like Crystal Skull. Let's not forget that. So it is what it is.
All right, then. So you're definitely a fan. You're going this weekend again to see it for the second time.
I'll be watching Ghostbusters 1 and 2 on my projector. Yeah.
Let's go to the Ghostbuster and the birthday boy himself, Mr. Preston. Your non-spoiler thoughts of Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I posted, I haven't posted a review, but I posted a tweet that said, you know, I got a new Ghostbusters movie. Who cares if it was meh? It's the thought that counts. And so I'm happy to have a Ghostbusters movie, but I have to admit it is a decent, if not fairly flawed ghost story, but it's not a very good comedy. And this might be where the franchise was heading, you know, because if you think about it, Afterlife wasn't necessarily a hilarious comedy. There were funny lines and some funny jokes, but the goal wasn't to, you know, make you laugh a ton. It was to, it was a warm embrace of bringing you back to the Ghostbusters franchise. You want jokes? Revisit 2016. Revisit Ghostbusters Answer the Call. That movie is filled with jokes. And everyone forgot that pretty much. So a revisit on that would be nice. But speaking of which, I may revisit this because my second screening of Afterlife, the movie played a lot better than the first time. And it played well the first time. This one didn't play so well the first time. So, yeah, there's an evil spirit trapped in an artifact. And then you get Ray involved early in the film. And I have to admit, this is one of Aykroyd's best performances in a while. Like, I feel he hasn't been good in some time. Like, he just kind of comes out and does his thing and then he's gone and there's no real presence there outside of I'm delivering lines like you know and you love me and off I go. But he had, I think, a little more humanity in this one, and I thought that was, you know, I'd missed that. So that was good to say that Aykroyd's the best part of a movie. It's been a while since I've said that. I did like Paul Rudd. The guy's just funny in everything he does. He may have been the MVP of this one. Unfortunately, Phoebe was the MVP of Afterlife, and she kind of gets lost in the shuffle here and makes some choices that I thought were highly suspect. They can actually get the whole gang in trouble. And one of my least favorite things in the world is when a kid gets everybody in trouble. Now, I thought one of the wisest things that the Ghostbusters franchise did recently was to make kids Ghostbusters. There's a whole new fleet of young people now who love Ghostbusters. And I'm like, genius. And there's hope for the future, you know. But in this movie, the kid gets everybody in trouble. And we're rooting for you. We're feeling for you. And then to me, I felt like she made some choices that just made you go, I don't know about that. But that to your other point, JT, about the plot kind of just coming to an abrupt halt, it's because the most of the movie, like 7/8 of the movie, is set up. And then there's a 1/8 where we run the clock out and we're done. I'm like, what? Even in the first one, by the time they, you know, overload the containment unit and it blows up, well, then other things happen. Ghosts run amok. They have to visit the mayor. They talk about it, do all this stuff. By the time we get to that containment unit overload place here, we're doing the finale and we're done. And I felt that left a lot missing in the story. Maybe they already felt they were juggling too many characters. I don't know. But Bill Murray was as funny as ever, but there were too many scenes. Like, I'll bring up Adam Witt again, and I'm always quoting him on this. We went to see Evan Almighty, and there was some scene early in the film with Evan and his kids, and they were advancing the plot, and then the scene ended. And Adam leaned over and he said, Judd Apatow would have put a joke in there. Just before they left, he would have put a joke in there. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. They would have. And there were so many scenes in Afterlife where, God, you could have put a joke in there before you left. Something to just remind us this is funny. Like, remind us how this all started. The heart was, because they had everything in place now. The heart was brought back in Afterlife. The jokes are still, everyone still wants that from 1984. You know, so they could have brought it all together, but there were just too many jokes. Too many punchlines missing, too many scenes ending on a flat note. And they continue to spend money in all the wrong places. The 2016 Ghostbusters movie, of course, I hate to talk numbers, but it's worth bringing up because in the wake of Cord Jefferson's great Oscar speech about can we make 10, $20 million movies instead of one $200 million movie, 2016 Ghostbusters spent $140 million or something and it made like 200. Afterlife spent 75 and it made 200. So, hey, success. Now we get another movie. And this is that movie that they spent $100 million on. And when you watch the extra $25 million that they spent between this and the first movie, it had to only be on the stuff we care about the least, the big visual ghosts and lots of noisy special effects. And, I think that money could have been spent better or not at all and just work on the script a little more. So, I'm going to give it another chance because, like I said, Afterlife got better on a second go. It is fun seeing the gang all together. And, you know, everything that they come up with is really kind of cool and smart, although a little muddled. It would involve spoilers to say where I think the ghost story loses its way. But, you know, it's enough to keep up with. But, boy, did they just miss a lot of jokes along the way. And, again, the abrupt ending was a shame. And that's two movies now with Carrie Coon where she's underutilized. This franchise should be lucky to have the likes of Carrie Coon in their movie, but they don't do enough with her here. They did a little more in the first one, obviously, as she was struggling with the memory of her father, and that was, you know, moving, actually. So, yeah, I think I've summed it all up. I think I've said enough.
Benny, take it away, pal.
So I'm similar to Paul. Like, I've liked Afterlife increasingly the more that I've watched it. And one thing that Afterlife does really great that very few legacy sequels do is they introduce the new crew and make you care about them. You know, so when this movie came along, I'm ready to go on the adventure with the new crew. I'm like, okay, I'm on board. I'm on board with Paul Rudd, the kids. I'm like, let's go have some ghost-busting adventures. And they're like, nah, screw that. We're just going to give you nostalgia little tidbits and exposition drops. And then that's what they gave us a steady diet of is here's an exposition drop. Here's your little nostalgia berry. And then they buried their own new crew that they spent this beautiful movie setting up. Like Paul Rudd is gone. Carrie Coon's gone. Finn Wolfhard's gone. The other kids, like they're randomly in this other city for no reason where they don't live for 5 minutes for no reason, you know? And then as much as I love the original Ghostbusters, and they're two of my favorite movies of all time, I watch them every year, multiple times typically. But Bill Murray doesn't give a shit, and he hasn't for years. And he still doesn't give a shit when he shows up in these movies. He didn't want to be in the 2016 one. He didn't want to be in Afterlife, and he doesn't want to be in this. You know, if the cats don't want to be in the movie, don't put them in the movie. You set up this new crew, use the new crew. And so the movie, it is a little dull for a Ghostbusters movie, and it's long and it's disjointed, but there's still some Ghostbuster fun to be had. But the annoying part is this crew is dead now. They've killed this new crew that they set up so beautifully. And I don't know if I want to go on any more journeys with them after this movie. And that's tragic for me. And that's where I'm at with this movie. It's not the worst movie in the world. Like, I've seen worse movies than it this week. But that being said, like, it's a franchise that I care a lot about. And, like, the 2016 one, it's not my cup of tea. But they were doing their own thing, and they were swinging for the fences. Like, this one just said, fuck it. And they left the bats in the car, and they didn't even come out to play. And that's how I feel about this movie.
This is not anywhere close to being a perfect movie. This is not the Ghostbusters movie I wanted this to be. And I mean, if you know me, you know that Ghostbusters is my favorite movie of all time, the original 1984 movie. However, I can agree with every one of your criticisms. I still had a lot of fun with this movie. This will not go down like anywhere close to being like my favorite Ghostbusters movie. In fact, this will probably fall bottom of the heap for me in terms of like my rankings of the Ghostbusters movies, but I still had fun with it. I'm hoping that this movie does well enough to be able to warrant a sequel. Like, I do think that there is chemistry there. I agree. There's too many characters in this movie. I agree. There's not enough villain in this movie. And boy, when you finally get the villain, how cool does he look and how great, like, is that like entrance that he has? And when he's putting the horns into his head, it's horrifying. And that's the end of the movie. Like, it literally, I agree 100% with all of the criticisms, but I do think that there was fun. I do think Kumail Nanjiani worked really, really well in this movie. It's kind of fun to see Kumail doing, like, I loved him in The Big Sick. I thought he was great in that movie. And then he's kind of stumbled along the way and not taking like the greatest roles. And I can't fault him for taking the MCU's Eternals. I dislike that movie quite a bit, but again, he was a bright spot in that movie. He was a bright spot in this movie too. I liked how they expanded the lore a little bit more. They explored more at this point, 40 years worth of ghosts exist in the containment unit. Like, there's more than just Slimer. There's more than Zool. There's more than, you know, Vigo. And so I like that they took a swing on something a little bit different. I like that there's they expanded the lore by having a Ghostbusters research facility. Like, where else would that go? Like, if you're going to revamp the Ghostbusters, you have to bring it into modern day. So I liked a lot of the threads. They just weren't executed right. They weren't written correctly. I feel like if Jason Reitman had directed this, it would have steered a different direction. And I feel like that's the direction that I would have liked this movie to go. All in all, again, I didn't dislike the movie. I had a good time with it. Now, we took all of the Haases. Like, yesterday, I took all the Haases. Both of my parents, my sister, her husband, my brother, and my niece. The same crew that went and saw Ghostbusters Afterlife. Now, when we left Ghostbusters Afterlife, there was not a dry eye amongst the Haases. We left this one, and my brother, the first thing he said is he was like, we got 3 minutes of the villain. And he's like, I would have liked to have seen more. Everyone's reaction was like, it was fun, but yeah, it's okay. And that's exactly where this movie falls with me. I had a really good time because I'm getting to see my childhood heroes, you know, on screen again, putting on the proton packs, busting ghosts. But at the same time, this isn't the Ghostbusters movie I wanted. It was fun. I don't know if this will age well. I hope it does well enough at the box office that we can warrant one more movie out of this original cast. Because otherwise, I think if this movie continues on a downward slope and this movie does not do the box office returns, I think that we're not going to see Ghostbusters for another 10 to 15 years. Paul said it best, it's always great to get a Ghostbusters movie out there. You guys hear me say this all the time. I will defend the 2016 Ghostbusters. Again, it's a big swing. It didn't necessarily work out for everybody, but I enjoyed it. There's a lot of redeeming qualities that you can enjoy in those. I feel the same about this movie. I do feel like some of the humor worked. I feel like what we got of Bill Murray in the movie is basically the days that Bill Murray showed up on set. They're like, oh shit, he's here. Okay, put him in and he could do X, Y, Z. So I don't like the finale. I think that is such a huge waste. You introduce all of these. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's go right into spoilers because I feel like there's a lot of things we're dancing around. Let me just say this. I just want to go to what Moose was just talking about. If you're bringing back the old cast, I agree. Dan Aykroyd was sign me up for as many days as you need me to be there. I love Ghostbusters. This is my baby. I can't wait to act again in it. Everyone else, even Annie Potts, just feels like she showed up. Ernie Hudson gets a little bit more to do, but the way the Afterlife teaser ended, remember the after credit scene? I was so excited to see what his character would do in this sequel. And if you're going to bring back these legacy actors, give them something to do besides just put on a proton pack. Give me something. And yeah. I just feel like it was literally I understand Afterlife them showing up for the last scene because it's it's the beginning and the old and the new. But if you're now saying, all right, we're bringing them back for the sequel, give them something to do. Give them some sort of residence in the story. They're just there. And if you're going to abandon those original actors that you introduced in the last film, you at least better give the old school actors something to really chew on. I agree Dan Aykroyd did get some stuff to do, but what is Peck doing in this movie? He is literally there for two scenes. He doesn't even really factor into the story at all. I was so excited when they showed him in the trailer. I was like, oh my God, he's gonna, He does nothing but yell up at the office. What were
you excited for? What did you expect from Walter Peck?
Anything.
Like, of course he's going to be the antagonist that doubts the Ghostbusters.
Yes, but, I mean, having, you know, at least he, in the original, he had to put, you know, he was messing with them. He had them, like, put away and stuff, and I don't know. I mean, I just felt
the guy
like
in the crowd that yelled "Dickless." That moment was priceless.
That was funny. We didn't even really get a good interaction with him and the old Ghostbusters. Like, it was mainly him just yelling at Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon about their daughter. And yeah, anyway, I just feel like they were a waste, and I was excited to see them in this movie. I got so much more to talk about. I'll let somebody else go.
I would say,
Go ahead, Benny. Go ahead, Benny.
The issue that I have with the old school crew, and you know, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, you know, those guys make up a large part of my childhood memories. You know what I'm saying? But there comes a time where if you don't want to be there, don't put them in the movie. Like, Bill Murray is not invested in these movies. He is not playing Peter Venkman. He's not trying to play Peter Venkman. He's a distraction in this movie more so than he lends to it, because he clearly is not there. He's just... This is Bill Murray showing up to get his daily rate. That's what this was. And so to me, it serves no purpose to have him in the movie. Like, it serves no purpose to have Janine there if she's not going to play the character from the original movie. She's literally just there to run up a flight of stairs one time and yell something incomprehensible. And Peck's not even really playing Peck from the original movie. He's playing an angry old man. He's not playing Walter Peck. So if you're going to bring back the legacy characters, they either need to play the legacy characters or you need to let the new characters have their time to shine. Because other than Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson, everyone that they brought back took away more than they added to this movie, in my opinion.
Well said.
It's interesting that they still get no respect. I always thought it was a tough place to write themselves out of when at the beginning of Ghostbusters 2 – you know, Aykroyd's moved on to the bookstore. Venkman's hosting TV shows, and they're doing birthday parties because they got nothing better. I'm like, these guys saved New York. But as Peck said, but there were no witnesses, right? So true. But how about when the Statue of Liberty came and walked down? Everybody saw that, right? Like, they did that, and so that you can't ride on the same stuff that he was angry about four movies ago. You know, so I thought that would be one way to advance his character. There's something different that he has an opinion about, because certainly they saved New York in front of they got everyone to sing, you know, like everyone was involved. No. There's no more no witnesses.
Also, the other Ghostbusters movies explain why the paranormal activity is coming back. It is always because, you know, Gozer's coming back. They blow up the Ghostbusters thing, so they all fly out. Like, they explain the paranormal activity in part two because, you know, there's a river of slime. In Afterlife, Gozer's literal, like, you know, fortress of tomb is, like, right there. This one, it starts off in New York, and Gozer just back, I guess? Even though, like, what? There's no explanation why there's paranormal activity back in New York. And the way Paul Rudd made it sound in Afterlife, I'm glad I watched Afterlife, because they act like nobody knew who Ghostbusters was, and nobody had ever seen a ghost before. It was like, oh, this is all internet stuff that... It makes no sense. The writing is all over the place. This movie, instead of like fixing some of it, just builds more problems up top, I feel like.
Also, Fortress of Tomb, band name, I call it.
Yes. It's my next tattoo.
Coachella, second stage.
That's right. I agree, though. I agree about Dan Aykroyd. I think, like, he finally had something to do. I feel like when Dan Aykroyd is Ray Stantz. Like, he's not given any lines. They're just like, Dan, go say some stuff. And he just sits down and is basically Ray Stantz. Like, I liked Aykroyd being a little more involved. I thought we were going to get a little more of Ernie Hudson. I kind of figured we weren't going to get as much of Bill Murray. You know, he's going to be peppered in. And I thought his interactions, like Bill Murray's interactions with Kumail Nanjiani, when he's like giving him the psychological test, I actually enjoyed that scene a lot. Because he obviously caught on that, you know, he was controlling the fire behind him. And then, yeah, when he, like, when the Murray shows up at the end, he basically adds nothing to the, like, climactic battle. That was one of my biggest gripes, is in the climactic battle, the original cast sure, they shoot their proton packs at the main villain. The main villain freezes the line. And then after that, how they contribute is to pull down a lever. That's their big contribution to the end of the movie. That one didn't quite work for me. And I understand, like, it had it, like, it's focusing on the new cast. It's Phoebe. It's the family. They're all helping her hold on to the proton pack and to shoot the bad guy. That worked for me. But come on, give these original, like, badass Ghostbusters, like, something to do other than pull a switch. That didn't work for me. It was such a miss.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, write something more interesting than just shooting people with proton packs. This, you know, the first one, Cross of Streams. Second one, River of Slime, Statue of Liberty. A lot of cool stuff there. Afterlife, you know, he builds the whole house to be a giant ghost trap, which I thought was a really cool concept, the way they tease it in the beginning at the end. And this one, it's like Kamal's a fire maker, and he comes down the pole in, like, this brass suit. I was just like, what is happening right now? And then, like, the girl with the one match, which was telegraphed in the when Susan introduced that match, and then as the movie was going, I was like, who cannot see where this is going? That girl's gonna break out that match, and Kamal's gonna save the day as the fire maker. There was no surprises in this movie at all. Everything I saw coming, and I thought Phoebe's story was, she's the teenager? Is that her story?
Let's talk about Phoebe and the relationship with this ghost.
Phoebe. Phoebe?
Yeah, Phoebe.
That is some showdown stuff. Yeah, that's beautiful.
She's the lead singer of Temple of Tomb. Well, let's talk about Phoebe and the ghost friend.
Awful.
Did this work for you guys? Did it not work for you guys? Like, did Phoebe's storyline in this movie overall, because they really put her front and center as the main character. I really kind of feel like it was her movie, Paul Rudd's movie, and Dan Aykroyd's movie. Those were kind of the three, like, at least main storylines. Finn Wolfhard, there was no development, no storyline. He reiterated 18 times that he's an adult.
It's him and Slimer. That's basically it.
Yeah, him and Slimer, basically. And that's his job in that movie, is basically to reintroduce Slimer to the next generation. To Paul's point, Carrie Coon completely underutilized. For a movie with too many characters, there wasn't a whole lot of character development, but they really pushed this relationship between Phoebe and the ghost girl. And how did that sit with you guys?
Well, I think it's with her and the girl, and her and Paul Rudd, the whole stepfather kind of thing. That didn't work for me. It felt forced. By the end, the moment where she says dad didn't land at all for me. The thing with the girl, I think she's supposed to learn, like, not all ghosts are bad, or I can't just be pointing my proton at ghosts. But she's the only ghost like that in the movie. All the other ghosts are these monsters, beasts, and she's running around and shooting and throwing a trap. So I don't know what we're supposed to learn. The main thing I learned from her was, I'm a grumpy teenager. And that's it.
Yeah, I didn't quite buy how ostracized she was to warrant her wanting to die to make a friend. Like, that was a lot to cover in an hour and a half before, you know, or maybe even less time. Maybe even before the 90-minute mark, she chooses to do that. And I went, oh, that is a lot to do. I mean, I didn't think you were that butthurt that you weren't a Ghostbuster. So, I mean, it just kind of was a little underdeveloped there. You guys saw Jurassic World Dominion?
It was awful.
This reminded me of that, in that all the characters were up together at the end, and it was just, like, too many characters. And this too, they were all in the garage, and it was like, this is too many of them here. I mean, I don't know, how you spread them out or have them some not be involved, but yeah, I totally had that same feeling as when the T-Rex picks up and there's like 12 people, like, you know, that we've been introduced over 30 years, and if the same thing happened here, I'm like, this is too much going on.
Speaking of that, when they leave the ghost station or the fire station, and there's like a group of people carrying them on, I immediately thought of the original film and Ghostbusters 2, where it felt like the whole city was in on this whole event. It felt epic in scale. And yet when they came out of that fire station, it's like, get us about 60 extras, just get them near the entrance. We'll recreate the scenes from the first two Ghostbusters, but it's going to feel like really watered down, really small, and have no epic feel to it. I was just like, this is...
But you know, leading up to that, the whole town was completely frozen over, right? Like, I'm not exactly rushing out the front doors to thank the Ghostbusters for that. If that's happening in my house.
I agree. It doesn't even make sense that the people were out there at all. Like, the whole thing with the city being taken over, with the ice, it's like an after effect that they just threw over the city. It never felt like when the freaking thing blew up and all the ghosts were like flying out of it, I thought, oh, this is kind of like the first movie. We're going to just see the montage of what's going around all over the city. And maybe I thought maybe they're actually going to leave the fire station and they're all going to have to split up into like their own little individual groups and try to contain the city.
Yeah.
While the original family is trying to fight. Like, there's so many cool things you could have done. Instead, none of that happened. And it just felt all rushed, quick, and very uneventful. And it felt cheap.
See, I think there were four or five really good ideals in the movie, but they gave all five ideals like 20 minutes of screen time. And they made one bad movie instead of just taking one of these storylines and going with another. Like the Phoebe's relationship with the ghost, I don't think is a terrible ideal. Dan Aykroyd establishes that you can have a romantic relationship with a ghost in the first movie. So I don't think that's out of bounds here that, you know, she's attracted to a ghost. She's lonely. She's coming of age. But like to Paul's point, like in 2 minutes of screen time, you're going from, hi, I'm a ghost. Let's play chess. I'm going to kill myself to be with you. that is a big leap in the relationship in a very small amount of screen time. And they do that repeatedly in this movie. Like, so even like with I can't say his last name. Can you
Nanjiani? Camille Nanjiani.
Yeah, Nanjiani. Yeah. Like even his character, like it's, hello, I'm an idiot, you know, an outcast in my family. I'm going to sell all this stuff. I'm a superhero that can wield firepower, you know, and this all happens in like 2 minutes. And they keep doing that. Even the stuff with Peck where, okay, I blew up a building. You can't be a Ghostbuster or anything. Everything just happens so quick. There's no chance for any of the story to.
Yeah. I agree, but I saw someone say this online, and I totally agree. It felt like they had a TV season of material they had to squish into a two-hour movie. Like, this was a Disney Plus series, and it had 10 episodes, 45 minutes each. All these ideas could have been fleshed out, and all could have built to something, but instead it just feels condensed into 2 hours, and nothing pays off because of that.
And stay with me on this, and correct me if I'm wrong. Try and do both those things. Ghostbusters is not my favorite movie of all time, but it's in my top three, the three funniest movies I've ever seen, Airplane, Blazing Saddles, and Ghostbusters. It's in my top 10 of all time, Ghostbusters. But number one is Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I think that has one of the most efficient scripts of all time because it sets up the hero in this glorious action sequence to kick off the film, and then he goes back to the school where he meets the CIA guys who set up everything. Here's what we're looking to do. Here's how it's dangerous. Hitler can't get his hand on this. Go. And then it's a 90 minutes of just awesome. You know, we know everything we want to do. So was it ever set up before? And I'm just thinking of this now as you brought it up. Was it ever set up beforehand that Garaka needed the voice of a human to call him into this earth out of the sphere thing? Or did that just happen at the time? Because like when she kills herself, when Phoebe kills herself and then, you know, he's like, haha, I needed you to speak the words like a human does. You did? Like, it reminds me of Black Adam. I don't know if you saw that. We were like, yeah, halfway through the movie, they're like, oh, he meant to die so he could rule the underworld. He did? And then at the end, well, now he controls the army of the dead. He does? Like, what? Look at Raiders set all this up and then you just play it out. And so I don't, that when that happened, I went, you need a human to speak the, did we ever set that up? Was that ever, like, I don't feel like it was. I could be wrong.
I honestly couldn't tell you.
Unfortunately,
I would have to watch the movie again to figure that out. I don't think I want to.
Yeah, I might.
No, I don't think that was ever set up. I mean, you obviously, there's the scene where the ghost girl's walking down the middle of the street, which again, like, I guess that just happens all the time in New York, that nobody is noticing, that she has this like small little conversation with Garaka. But obviously he's speaking to her in Sumerian or whatever dead language he's talking to her, because she just kind of alludes like she's in cahoots with him. But yeah, I don't think it's ever established that like a human needed to be the person to release Garaka.
I mean, I guess it could be, didn't feel satisfying for that to be a surprise plot point.
What did you guys think of Garaka when we finally got to see him?
He did look cool. Yeah.
He looked cool, but does he stand up next to Viggo and Gozer? Like, no, he's
agreed.
He's like a footnote compared to these people. We never really get a chance to, you know, even really understand where he's coming from, what his history is, what he needs. Like, Gozer in the like 5 minutes that she's in the end of Ghostbusters is way more memorable than the 2 minutes he's in this movie. And that's the thing is, I love the villains in the first two Ghostbusters because there's so much, like, I guess they tried to build like this myth about him. I did think the opening scene was kind of cool where the firemen go in and everyone's frozen. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is cool. We're building a little bit of, you know, backstory here. But like you said, the movie kind of ignores him for the most part. He's just an ice ball. And then he finally comes in and he's gone before you know what the hell's happened. So disappointing.
Iceball is the other band that Phoebe sings in.
By the way, if you're looking for another Ghostbusters movie, this Frozen Empire did not have as big a weekend as Ghostbusters 2016 did on opening weekend. So that was fighting against toxic fanboy, you know, barrage. And this was like, we all loved Afterlife. We can't wait to see this. So, ouch, it didn't not do so well.
I was not a big fan of that last Ghostbusters movie Paul Feig did, but I would probably watch that over watching this again, because even though at least I laughed a few times at that movie, there was jokes that do hit once in a while. I really can't stress enough, like, I don't think I laughed once throughout this whole movie. It was like the needle didn't move up or down. It was just flatline the whole time. And it's like, at the very least, if I had a couple good laughs, I could be like, okay, you know, go see the movie. Maybe I'll rewatch again, but like, I just don't remember laughing except for maybe a chuckle here and there at Kumail's delivery, because Kumail's just a funny actor, period. And I think the way he delivers jokes, he's just so sharp with it. You know, he comes from stand-up comedy, so. But I can't think of anything, like even Paul Rudd, who's like one of my favorite comedic actors, like he does his best to try to be funny in this movie, but nothing really stuck out.
I think there was some setup for the Garaka voice thing, but unfortunately it was delivered by Patton Oswalt, and you guys know my feelings on that. So I completely shut down the whole wax cylinder scene.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'd have to watch it again to find out. But for it to fly by me like that means it's a muddled script. I got the idea that the arc, you open it up, you know, my God, yes, that's what the Hebrews thought, because they're all dead because we opened the ark and it's all right there. And then go. I mean, there's so much going on in the, like I said, 7/8 of the movie is setup, and that's a lot of setup and a lot of things where that must have got lost on me if they mentioned it at all.
Well, I mean, I think at this point in time, we've kind of gone through the movie. We talked about what worked for us, what didn't work for us. Let's give our final thoughts. And then as we give our final thoughts, rank the Ghostbusters movie in your order from favorite to least favorite. Paul Preston, why don't you give us your final thoughts and, of course, your Ghostbusters rankings?
Sure. I'm going to give it a second chance because it is, you know, they did bring the gang back together, and there's probably some charm in there that I missed. But overall, yeah, I thought it was muddled and just, again, a decent ghost story with some flaws, but not so much a comedy. And I didn't go to the first Ghostbusters for all the tech and the gear and the ghost, you know, lore. I went because I love those three guys, you know, and then you throw in Rick Moranis to boot and Sigourney Weaver, other people I enjoy. It was all a win. So, this missed that charm for me, but I may give it another shot. So, number one, Ghostbusters 84. Number two, Afterlife. Number three, Ghostbusters 2016. Number four, Ghostbusters 2, which, if you remember, has scenes like the darkroom scene where they're developing the pictures and it all catches on fire. They put the fire out, and that's the end of the scene. They left that scene without a joke, and they do that too often in Ghostbusters 2 as well. Just watch Ghostbusters. They don't get through a conversation without five jokes. The whole library sequence is just joke. And it's referring to things that happened that are just bizarre. Like the time you try to drill a hole in your head with the great sponge migration. Like, what are they even talking about? This shit is hilarious. You know, and there's a lot of that is missing, except for a few things. Maybe Patton Oswalt said that were in a similar vein. But so that's what puts that at number two. And then sadly, Frozen Empire at the bottom.
Benny, how about you, buddy?
So my overall thoughts is, since you know, we've had a few mentions of Indiana Jones. This movie is a lot like The Dial of Destiny for me, and that it in and of itself is not the worst movie in the world. But it takes something that's inherently joyous and exciting, and it makes it sad. And I can't stand when movies do that at all. And so if I'm ranking the Ghostbusters, it's Ghostbusters 1, Ghostbusters 2, Afterlife. And then I have to watch this one more time before I can decide between it and Answer the Call. Right now, I would have it above Answer the Call. But like I said, I need one more viewing before I make a firm call on that.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, like a lot of people I saw online, like, oh, this movie is the worst movie. It's up there with Madame Web. No, this movie, Madame Web was just, was not made competently. It was horrible. It's trash. This movie was made decently, but it just has no life to it. You know, it's a Ghostbusters movie. Should be some life into the film. But, you know, like when I saw Madame Web and it was horrible, I didn't get mad. It was a car crash wreck of a movie, but I didn't care about the passengers. I care about these passengers. I love Ghostbusters. I love the original OG crew. I love, you know, the series growing up. So even though this movie is not as bad as Madame Web, this hurt me more because I had so much more invested in this franchise and these characters. And I just want them to see done justice. And while I think Afterlife was a great start, and I was like, man, I really love that jumping off part for a new franchise, I feel like they just really fumbled the ball with the sequel. Like, I don't see me going back to this movie very often. Like I said, if I at least had some laughs or some fun. And you talk about Ghostbusters 2, Paul. You said how, like, there's some scenes where it's like there's no joke there. But at least it's that scene with, like, the pictures, it scared me a little bit. It was a little bit – had a little bit of edge of darkness to it where, like, there were moments where you felt like there were actual danger and stakes. No point in this movie, Frozen Empire, do I feel like there's any danger or any stakes. So people just getting frozen doesn't scare me very much. The ghosts here feel like cartoons. They don't feel scary at all. Now, I don't need Slimer to be scary. He never was. But even, you know, the big bad guy in this, he's always scary by voice and look. He's not scary by, like, there's no actual filmmaking of, like, suspense or, yeah, it just felt like there were no stakes in this movie. A lot of people say this felt like a cartoon, the real Ghostbusters cartoon made into a movie. I don't think that's what you want with a Ghostbusters movie. Unless, like I said earlier, you're making it for a new generation. This feels more like a kid's movie to me than a Ghostbusters movie. This is, you know, Muppet Babies. This ain't the Muppets. So my rankings will be Ghostbusters 1, Ghostbusters 2. Even though Ghostbusters 2 repeats a lot of the first one, the fact you're getting your starting four in their prime, I'm just always going to favor those guys. So 1, 2, Afterlife, 2016, and Empire would have to be on my bottom. But I'm opening to watch it again. I will watch it again once it's streaming. I'll give it a shot at home. Because even though when I have, you know, a reaction like this to movies, I always like to give them a second chance. So I will give it a second chance when it does start playing on whatever streaming service it'll throw on.
Same here, and we'll see if Empire strikes back. Sorry, Moose. I was you still had to go. Sorry.
I feel like we should drop the mic and walk off stage right now. That was perfect. All in all, like I said, this is not a perfect movie. It's not the Ghostbusters movie I wanted, but I do cling to the fact that I have Ghostbusters 84. I have Ghostbusters 2. I have Afterlife. I have 2016. Like, I have five good Ghostbusters movies. They're not great. One of them is amazing. The second one is really, really good. Third is really, really good. Fourth is good. Fifth is fine. I think that there was still some chemistry within the cast here. I think that was way too many characters. I think I could have done without. I liked Podcast in the first one. I could have done without him in this one. I liked Lucky in Afterlife. I could have done without Lucky in this one. Who the hell was the British guy that was wearing a proton pack at the end too? Somehow he's in there. At least this movie introduced us to Pukey, the cute little round ghost that takes out that guy. I did already buy that Funko Pop this morning. I do think that the ghosts in this movie were really cool. I don't think there was enough actual ghost busting. I wish we would have seen more of that. Like, there was a ghost that was, like, at the Ghostbusters training facility that just looked horrifying. And it's like, man, like, how cool would it have been if all of these ghosts got out and they had to go after them? Like, anyways, all in all, my final thoughts are it's a fun movie. It's a fun Ghostbusters movie. I wasn't looking for a real Ghostbusters movie. I had aged out by the time that cartoon had come to be, but I am glad that they made another movie with this cast. I'm glad I got to see my Ghostbusters. I'm glad I got to see my Janine back on screen again. I hope we get one more out of them. I don't think we're going to. If this is it for this Ghostbusters franchise, we have Afterlife. That was great. We had a good time with them on this one. So all in all, I would recommend seeing it in theaters. It is a fun movie. If you have kids, take your kids. They're going to have a good time with this movie. And my Ghostbusters rankings, 84, of course, is going to top it. Ghostbusters 2, then we'll go Afterlife, then we'll go 2016, then we're going to go Frozen Empire. Anything below 84 can potentially go up and down, depending on the day, the mood. I still contend that the Scolari brothers scene in Ghostbusters 2 is the most fun you will have watching the Ghostbusters in action. I think it is a ton of fun, but alas, we are coming to the end of our Ghostbusters Empire review, possibly of the Ghostbusters franchise. We'll see. But we do want to thank, of course, our real-life Ghostbuster himself, Mr. Paul Preston. Paul, where can people find more of you?
TheMovieGuys.net and at The Movie Guys everywhere there's social. Find out about Ghostbuster Party Rentals, the LA Film Locations Tour, and, of course, reviews and podcasts, like you mentioned before, the Ford Fiesta. Everything about Harrison Ford. And actually, I just finished a podcast called Countdown to Five as we were looking at the previous four Ghostbuster movies getting ready for number five. Nice. So that's out on themovieguys.net as well.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for being here. We could not have had anybody else be our Ghostbusters reviewer other than you, sir.
And I wish I loved it, but, it was my birthday and I had all my friends, three or four of my friends go with me. And so we had a good time, but afterwards we had this very conversation.
Fair enough. Well, we are going to call it a night, folks. Thank you all for tuning in. Paul, thank you. Who are you going to call?
Not Frozen Empire.
Good night, everybody. Good night, Ghostbusters franchise.
Ouch.
Wow.